The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
And welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for March 25th, 2017. At the beginning of pretty much every week, I'm never certain what the next show will contain. I'm always searching for new and interesting guests, and this week, although we have two very familiar voices on the show, we also have someone new who just blew me away. She's 87 years old. She's a woodworker. She works out at the gym several days a week, and she has been a warm showers hostess for 10 years. If you don't know what warm showers is, I would suggest that you might want to go to warmshowers.org and take a look. This past week, Adventure Cycling's Jim Sayre, who's traveling cross-country with his daughter Lucy, stopped at Carol Montgomery's bunkhouse and uncovered the rarest of gems in hospitality and kindness. Carol just celebrated 10 years as a warm shower stopover for cyclists who travel through her part of Texas, and her story is nothing less than remarkable. Carol will be with us a little bit later in the show. My first guest today is Rails to Trails President Keith Laughlin. We spoke with him just after the election last fall when so much was uncertain about how a new infrastructure policy might affect programs and projects such as Rails to Trails. Keith will bring us up to speed about what is going on in what often feels a disjointed and chaotic Washington, D.C., and gives us a suggestion about honing in on specific contacts who will, in the end, be making important decisions about where infrastructure money will be distributed. Then we're going to head on down to Carmine, Texas, and talk with Carol Montgomery about her gracious hospitality as a warm showers hostess. And finally, we talk with my man in the know about the spring classics, Dan Worry. He always has his ear to the ground about what's going on in pro racing. And since we're just getting into the thick of the iconic 8 one-day races, I figured it was time to get the real story. We're full up this week, so let's head on down to Washington, D.C., and we're going to check in with Keith Laughlin. Good morning, Keith. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks so much for speaking with me this week.
Thank you, Diane. It's my pleasure.
On March 17th, which was St. Patrick's Day, I received a message from Rails to Trails that the government's skinny budget was out, and so might be the programs that are so important to us. What can you tell us about the new infrastructure proposals?
Well, President Trump has not come out with his infrastructure proposal yet, and that supposedly has been pushed off until 2018. But he did come out with his new budget for fiscal 18, which starts in October, and we were very distressed to see a $2.4 billion cut in transportation. And it was a skinny budget in that it didn't have a lot of money in it. Also, it didn't have a lot of details. So we're not sure exactly where that's coming from. But one thing that did really concern us is that there was enough detail to indicate that the Tiger program was being eliminated. And that's an acronym that stands for Transportation Investment Generating Economic Recovery. It's been around since 2009, and it's been a really popular, innovative program that has allowed communities to put together transportation proposals that combine their needs for roads, for transit, and for bikes, all in one proposal. And you know, a lot of transportation spending, there's a road pot and a transit pot and a bike pot. This is the place where communities were able to put it all together in a multimodal way. Very creative, innovative, popular program, and President Trump has proposed eliminating it.
Well, it seems like he's proposing to eliminate a lot of important things here in the country while sort of saying we need to do more defense. But I wanted to know if the money spent by the federal government works for projects at the state and local level. So how would, say, a Rails to Trails program be impacted by the Tiger Grants or by no money from the feds at all?
Well, but with the Tiger Grants, that's a specific grant program. So if that is zeroed out, it means that we would no longer have the opportunity to work with local communities to build bike and trail components into those Tiger Grants. And there was a great one in Cleveland. We've also were part of one in Philadelphia that's had a big impact. We're now doing some work in Brownsville, Texas, where they've had a Tiger Grant that's helping to build out their bike infrastructure. So that's just a really creative program that would be off the table. In terms of other bike ped spending, there's not enough detail yet in the budget to know what the impact would be of that $2.4 billion cut. But that would be a cut that would probably result in reductions in programs that each state Department of Transportation administers. It's federal money that goes through the State Department of Transportation that can support bike and trail projects at the local level.
So do you think that states like Ohio and Pennsylvania, you know, these eastern states, well, all over the country, do you think that the money that's already there is going to be able to cover the projects that are in place, or are we going to end up with projects that don't get finished?
That's always possible, and we've seen things happen in the past where they do what is a rescission, which is they pull back money that was already given but not obligated. That's possible. But, Diane, we're going to be working really hard to make sure these cuts don't occur at all. And I think that we have been talking to both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats in both the House and the Senate, and, you know, it's our hope that the cut that the president has proposed just will not materialize. I think that, as you said, there's lots of cuts proposed in programs like Meals for Wheels and other programs that are very popular. I just don't think there's going to be any political support for doing that. And I think that our trail and bike programs will fall in that same category.
It seems like a lot of the programs that they're bandying about, a lot of the conversation is deflecting from other things that are going on. Is there anything but chaos going on down there?
There's an awful lot of uncertainty, and this is what happens when you have a new president come in who really tries to change things, and he's now someone who his party controls both houses of Congress. And so I think at the beginning there were some assumptions that there were going to be these big sweeping changes, but I think that the more that the debate has gone on, the more that we see that a lot of these programs have a lot of bipartisan support. And so, you know, it's our hope that if people at the local level, you know, bike activists, bike trail users, raise their voice, let their members of Congress know that these things are important to them, that we'll be able to turn back any of these cuts. We've done it in the past, and we know this drill. And I think that as long as we're vigilant and keep our eye on the prize, I think we can turn back these cuts so that this investment in bike infrastructure continues.
Yeah, that would be really, really good. So I know that all of our Congress people, all of our senators, all the legislators are being inundated with, you know, card campaigns and marches and all these kinds of things. Is there anything you think we should do as cyclists and pedestrians, of course, to bring our particular concerns in front of them, along with all these gazillions of other things? Is there anything that could make our concerns stand out?
Well, I think at this point, The most important thing is that both the House and the Senate have appropriations committees. These are the committees that actually dole out the money. And I think that if there's anyone who is in the district or in the state of a member of the appropriations committee, this is the time to contact them and let them know that you support continued federal investment in trails, biking, and walking. And that, if they hear that message, then I think we will prevail. But it's most important right now to talk, to focus on those people, because they're going to be making the immediate spending decisions.
So the appropriations committee members, you'll be able to find them, I take it, online?
Yes, that's not hard to find online. Yes, both the House and the Senate.
All right. I want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Keith Laughlin in Washington. Let's switch gears a little bit. I got another email, which I'm not by you. Usually you sign them, but this was by somebody who does, I think, project development. And opening day at Rails to Trails is coming up. That's kind of joyous in the midst of our chaos.
We like to celebrate the positive as well as be prepared to defend against the negative. And so every year, it's usually the first Saturday after the beginning of baseball season, we hold an event called Opening Day for Trails, and we're doing that again this year. It will be on Saturday, April 8th, and we encourage everybody to get out. At present time, we have about 120 events planned nationwide, and that includes a ride hosted by every performance bicycle store in the country. And so if people want to participate, you know, please get on our website at railstotrails.org/opening day. And you can register there. You can find events in your area, and you can register to win one of three free bicycles.
Oh, nice. Nice. So if there are no events planned in somebody's area, they can actually put one together and then post it up on the site?
Yes, you can put your own event together if there's none in your area. Or the other thing you can do is just, you know, you can register there. And then if you want to upload, you go out on the trail, take some pictures and upload it to Twitter or to Facebook with the hashtag of RTC Opening Day.
How cool is that? The last thing I want to talk about, which is important to Rails to Trails, it seems like RTC and Adventure Cycling are doing really well in a time when membership is lagging in a lot of these organizations. How are you doing so well? What keeps people engaged with Rails to Trails?
I wish we had a real magic formula, but I think it's this, that people love the trail experience, and that once they get out on the trail, they become, you know, true believers. And so we have, you know, more than 100,000 dues-paying members that really help to support our organization. And we are regularly in contact with them, both in terms of asking people to be advocates to support the policy, but also to really celebrate and do the fun things like getting out for something like opening day. So we try to make sure that we're not always totally serious on the policy side, and that we actually, you know, focus on the fun as well, because I think that that's a big part of the message, just how much fun it can be to get out on trail on your bike.
It is. We have one here that we really, really like. I wanted to ask you one thing about the Cumberland Trail. People have been saying that it's got some issues and we wanted to ride it this year. What happens when a trail like that needs major repair? How is that financed?
Are you talking about the Great Allegheny Passage?
I am.
Okay. I'm actually going to ride that twice this next summer right now.
Oh, nice.
That is it's different almost everywhere. It depends on who the trail manager is, and sometimes it's almost always a public agency. Sometimes it's a municipality, sometimes a county government, sometimes the state. And so it is really dependent upon the budgets of those agencies, often in the Parks Department, to keep the trails properly maintained. And I think there's a lot of volunteer opportunities there in terms of people working with their local trail managers. But it's also the kind of thing where, from an advocacy standpoint, it's important not just to raise your voice on things like funding to create the trail, but also funding and support for maintaining it over time, so that experience remains one that's really pleasurable because the trail is maintained.
Yeah, I told you I was only going to ask one more question. I guess I lied. I was wondering, are there any new trails opening soon?
Oh, that's yes. And I can't give you big names off the top of my head right now, but we do have a lot of times it isn't just openings. It is expansions is by far the biggest thing that happens is that a 20-mile trail may become 25 miles or et cetera, because they're continually adding on more mileage. And so these days we have a couple thousand trails across the country, and we do occasionally have brand new ones, but the biggest part of the growth of the movement now is continuing to build out existing trails and lengthening.
Well, I know you and I spoke about an Adirondack trail at one point and that it was going to happen. Is that still going to happen?
Yes, those conversations are still in the works up there in New York State, and as far as the latest I heard is that's still moving ahead. But that's happening. This is happening almost like every state in the country. There is something underway right now in terms of either a new trail or expanding an existing trail or connecting trails together is a lot of what's happening now in terms of connecting trails into systems.
Yeah, that's a good thing. Well, I appreciate you talking with us, and I always learn something new. Once again, it's railstrails.org or railstrails.org. I don't think you need the two in there, right?
Yeah, no, you do need the
two. Oh, you do.
It's rails2trails.org.
Okay. Keith Laughlin, thank you so much for talking with me today. We will make sure to let our listeners know how to contact the people who need to be contacted in Washington.
Okay. Thank you very much, Diane.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Keith Laughlin joined me from his office at Rails to Trails in Washington, D.C. We need to take a break. When we come back, we will talk a little bit more about how to contact and who to contact in Washington, D.C. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and as promised, I wanted to give you some information on how to contact members of the House and Senate Appropriations Committees to let them know how important funding for cycling and pedestrian infrastructure projects are to you. If you are interested in letting your voice be heard, you can log on to either appropriations.house.gov/about/members for the House of Representative members, or appropriations.senate.gov/about/members for the Senate members. Each of these sites will give you a full list of those members along with the states they represent. I'm not sure if you have to be in a state to contact one of these representatives. I think they could all stand to hear from us. Obviously, there are a lot of other issues on the table besides transportation and infrastructure, but as Keith suggested, your voice can make a big difference. I will post those two web addresses to our Facebook page and mention Keith's suggestions on Twitter. Let's move on with our show. We are going to head on down to Carmine, Texas, and speak with Warm Showers' gracious hostess, Carol Montgomery. Hello, Carol. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thank you so much for joining me on the show this week.
You're welcome.
Well, I want to know a little bit more about you and your bunkhouse and how you became such a popular place for cyclists to stop by in Texas.
Well, it worked out very well because in 1982, I started building my own house, and I live on a piece of property where I had already built a bunkhouse to stay in while I was building the house. And so when I finished the house in 1987, I ended up with a bunkhouse, and it's a 30 by 50 room over a barn. And I've put six beds up there and six singles and a double bed. And I have a place to cook, have a bathroom and a shower, and it's ideal for guests. So I have just hadn't even been using it very much. That when in 2007, I went into my little town of Burton, and there was a couple on a tandem bicycle, and it was obvious they were touring. So I started talking to them. I'd never heard of warm showers. And I started talking to them and invited them to come out. It was a freezing weather and the wind was blowing. It was Valentine's Day. And I invited them out to my place to spend the night. And they told me about warm showers and I joined the next day.
Wow, that's a great story. So it's been 10 years. I know when we spoke earlier before we actually got ready to come on the air that you have been a warm showers hostess for 10 years. I think that's awesome. But it is so much appreciated by the cyclists. And the reason I found you was Jim Sayers from Adventure Cycling and his daughter Lucy stopped by last week.
Right, they sure did.
There were some great pictures of you and Lucy in your bunkhouse. So over the years, the 10 years, do you know how many cyclists have been through?
Well, I had to kind of make an educated guess because for 3 years, I didn't do anything, but just I had no record of their stay. They just came and I, you know, gave them the dinner and a night's lodging and a breakfast. And they went on their way and I got to thinking, you know, I need some record of who I've seen. And so I made this page for my guest book. And I asked them to fill it out, which has their name and their phone number and their blog, if they write one, how many countries they visited on their bike, what their plans are, you know, what town they're from originally. And I asked them to make comments. Well, I've had some wonderful comments through the years. Some of them have almost put me in tears. And then I take their picture and I attach that picture to the page that they fill out. And what's made it so nice is that other cyclists will look through that, and they'll see people they've ridden with in another state or another country.
No kidding.
A real good connection.
So unlike many warm showers hostesses, you really go way beyond and above what most people expect. You know, we do expect the comment is warm showers. So hopefully they get a warm shower and a place to stay. But you feed them, too. And you were telling me how some of the food comes to you through your senior center.
Right, through my senior center, through my church, through the little, we have a town of 350, 8 miles from here. And when there is a function, like today, this morning, we had senior day. They had this big pot of soup left over. So I put it in containers and brought it home. I'm expecting 2 warm showers guests tomorrow night, and I'll have some soup ready for them. And one of them is a vegetarian, so I'll fix lots of veggies. And you had asked me how many I had seen. Well, what I did in 2010, December of 2010, I started this guest book, and I've counted all the ones every year since then and taken an average and added those 3 years, and it comes to almost 800 cyclists.
Oh, my goodness. You know what we haven't told anybody is exactly where you are in Texas.
Well, I'm in the country off of Highway 290 between the towns of Burton and Carmine. They're both small towns. One has 200 people. One has 350. And then those little places are between Austin and Houston, about halfway.
So let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Carol Montgomery. She is down somewhere between this and that in a little town. Do you actually have a town? Does your place have a town, a name?
Well, I'm in the country. The name of my property is Acres Alegres, which means happy acres in Spanish.
Nice. That is so nice. Do you have a story or two about particularly interesting or unusual guests who have been with you?
Diane, I probably have 100 stories. You're not going to live long enough to hear all my stories. But a couple that I had about a month ago really impressed me. He is from France originally. She's from the United States. It's a married couple. They live in Germany, and they purchased 2 rent houses and obviously paid for them. So they cycled. They had got on their bicycles in 2006. They are still cycling. They've been to 102 countries, 6 continents, and they have no end in sight. They get the rent house money every month, and they just continue to ride. And when they were here, their worker bees, I heat with wood, and I had a lot of logs that needed to be split. They split a huge pile of wood for me, and I had a big corn crop this year. They went to my corn orchard, and they picked 9 9 5-gallon buckets of pecans.
Wow.
So it was very profitable having them here.
Yeah, they got a place to stay. They got good food, and they helped out. And I imagine a lot of cyclists are willing to spend some time and give you a hand if you need it.
They are. They almost always ask me, but sometimes they get in when it's almost dark and it's too late to do anything outside. That's where all my work is.
Yeah, right. Of course. Of course.
But I usually have a job for them. Yes.
That's good. Have any riders come through with pets? Anybody bring a dog?
Yes.
Yeah?
I've had two or three with small dogs, and that was no problem at all. But I had one person with two big dogs, and that was a problem. They don't usually have dogs, and most of the time, I'm just going to say 99% of the time, that is not a problem. They're welcome. I also have a B&B, and I let my B&B guests bring dogs, too.
Whoa, wait. You have a B&B in addition to the bunkhouse?
Yes, it's on a 10-acre piece next to where my house and the bunkhouse is.
Oh, how interesting. That is so cool.
Well, they pay.
Well, yes.
And, you know, but what's interesting is I cook for my warm showers guests, but I don't cook for my B&B guests. It's just a B.
It's just a bee?
Yeah.
That's great. So, I one of the questions that I have is about when riders come through, are there places you recommend that they should go see within your, you know, immediate area, maybe within 8-10 miles?
We have some unique places. The thing that the little town of Burton that I'm 8 miles from, what they're famous for is we have the oldest working cotton gin in the United States.
No way.
And so they can take a tour of that. But see, most of the time, they don't have the time to do that. They're on their way someplace. So, but I do tell them about that, and I recommend it. And also about 13 miles from here, on their route, is a beautiful music conservatory. And it's just an incredible place. And I encourage them to stop. And occasionally they do. I'm a volunteer there, so I just tell them who to talk to. And that woman very willingly shows them around, and it's a beautiful place. And they do that occasionally.
A cotton gin and a music conservatory; those are two very interesting and sort of different places,
yes,
to go and do. That
places.
Would be fun, though. So, I want to ask you a little bit about warm showers and what advice you might give somebody who's listening to the show about becoming a warm showers hostess, about somebody or a host, somebody who is willing to open their home or their extra space to cyclists. What it is you found that is good and or bad about it?
Well, the perfect situation, of course, is to have a separate building. Now, a lot of people do it in their spare bedrooms and they come into their homes, but I'm a single woman on an acreage out in the country at a dead-end road, and I'm much more comfortable having my privacy and letting them have theirs in a separate building.
Sure.
Now,
sure.
If you're a family and you feel good about having a person, and, you know, it's worked 99% of the time. I never feel threatened by any of my warm showers guests. I see whole families. I see couples. I see singles. It's just a real mix of people, and they're all just very interesting people, and I found them to be very trustworthy, very good folks to be around, very easy to talk to and deal with.
Yeah, I've been in the bicycle business for over 40 years, and I find bicycle people to be, for the most part, very honest, very trustworthy, and very friendly.
Yes.
I wanted to tell people that most people would never realize how old you are, not by listening to you or about what you do. You are showing no signs of slowing down, but you told me you are 87.
I'll be 87 April the 7th.
Oh, my. Well, that's only about a week from now, right? A couple weeks away. But you also told me you were a woodworker. What does that mean?
I've been doing woodworking for 52 years. I have a very nice shop, and I just returned from the John C. Campbell School, where I took a course in wood turning. That's in Brasstown, North Carolina.
So is that using a lathe, a wood lathe?
Yes, a wood lathe.
Yes, and you have one? Of course you do.
I have three.
Oh, my husband would love you.
A lot of women have said that to me.
Exactly. So the last thing I want to know about is your tiny house. You told me you're building a tiny house. You don't intend to live in that tiny house, do you?
No, okay. I don't. It does not have a bathroom. There may be an outhouse in the future, but right now it is really a room, and it's really quite cute. It's the room itself is 8 by 12, 97 square feet, and I'm using all recycled material to build it. Someone gave me a lot of flooring, and I'm doing the ceiling right now in the flooring. You know, it's wood, and the flooring has been used a lot lately by other people in making walls and ceilings and so forth. That'll be most of the interior. Then I'm going to be using the same material that I'm building it with to do build a bookcase and a stairway to go into the loft. I have a little 3.5 by 8 foot loft.
Nice.
Yeah, it's cute.
It sounds cute. It sounds like a dollhouse, you know.
I look like that. If I have an open house, I can only have like 4 people at a time in the house.
A very small tea party, right?
Right.
Right. I just think this is delightful, and I have to say, on behalf of all the cyclists you've hosted and those to come, thank you, because the cycling world loves people like you, and we really need people like you, and we appreciate people like you. And if I ever get down there, I am going to come see you.
I would love that, and I enjoy very much being a Warm Showers host. It's just enriched my life as well as I hope I've enriched the life of others.
I am sure that is the case. Thank you so much, Carol. Have a wonderful evening. Enjoy your Warm Showers guests tomorrow. And maybe we'll talk again soon.
All right. Thanks, Diane.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Oh, my goodness. Does it make you want to become a Warm Showers host or hostess? What a delightful lady. Carol Montgomery down in little teeny town near Carmine, Texas. I am delighted to have been able to talk with her. We're going to go take a break. As usual, we'll come back and we'll find out what's going on in the iconic classic, spring classics, when we talk with Dan Worry. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
Good morning, Dan. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for talking with me on the show this week.
Oh, it's always great to be with you, Diane.
Well, we're in the middle of spring classics, and I thought it was time to catch up with you. So for those who might not know, although I can't imagine, there are 8 iconic one-day races, including things like Milan, San Remo, Tour of Flanders, Paris-Roubaix. Can you explain how these events actually kind of kick off the cycling season?
Absolutely. Well, there's a distinction. There's the technical start of the cycling season, and then there's the real start, right? So in January, the World Tour season actually begins in Australia each year at the Tour Down Under. Now, that's sort of the technical start. As you know, a lot of these athletes plan their, you know, their physical peaking around the races that they're going to be targeting. So January happens to be a pretty awful time for most of the cyclists, the pros that are going to be targeting things like the Tour de France and you know, the later season races. So, you know, the Tour Down Under is always sort of an interesting mix of riders to sort of get the season started. But then, the real start to the meat of the season, you're right, is the classics. And as you said, there are 8 of these races. We call them the classics because they have this incredible history, Diane. Some of these races go back to like the 1890s. And so, you know, we have well over, you know, 100 and 120 or so years of racing history in some of these places. And you're right, we started last weekend, Milan-San Remo, kicked the classic seasons off in Italy. In Italian, they call it La Primavera, is the sort of the nickname for Milan-San Remo, which means the spring. And so it is held usually on the weekend that is closest to the beginning at the start of spring, and is by far and away the longest one-day race in the season. It is a really grueling, long race that was held this past weekend and won by Sky's Michael Kwiatkowski. And then we move on into out of Italy and really into Belgium and northern France for the seven remaining classics. There are the cobbled classics, things like the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix, which go over those legendary cobblestones, if you can even call them cobblestones. We should talk about that, Diane, because
those
cobbles are insane. And then we move on to later after the cobbled classics, we move into kind of southeastern Belgium, into the Ardennes region, for what we call the Ardennes classics, the Amstel Gold and Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège. So this is a really exciting exciting time of year.
Well, one of the things that I want to bring up right at the start is there are a lot of companion women races to some of these big one-day races for men. In fact, an American won last weekend, and that was a pretty exciting event. I think it's pronounced Corinne Rivera.
Corinne Rivera. And, Corinne is one of those riders, and funny to watch, because she feels like someone that has been around forever. She's been on the racing scene for roughly a decade or so, and yet she's only 24 years old.
Yeah, right.
She began as a teenager and has, at this point in her career, I think the number is 70, that she has racked up 70 separate national championships at different age divisions and in different disciplines. She's done it in criterium and on the road and on mountain bike. And you name it. I mean, Corinne Rivera has really sort of started as like a child prodigy of cycling. But you're right that here recently she picked up absolutely, what I would consider the biggest win of her career. She was known as, for the longest time, and I think is sort of breaking out of this mold, but has been known as kind of a criterium sprinter. She's got an amazing sprint on her, but has really been sort of spreading her wings and working in other parts of her game. She's, certainly, she's not a climbing specialist, but as a one-day rider has definitely learned to hang with some of the best, and so is just becoming increasingly well-rounded rider. She spent a lot of the last couple of years riding domestically here for United Healthcare, where she did a lot of criterium racing. But this year she is riding for a team called Sunweb, which has actually been around for a while. You might remember the Skill Tools sponsored cycling teams for a while, and then this team Sunweb is sort of on the women's side, at least, the remnants of what used to be team Argo Shimano. And so, as is not uncommon in cycling, they've changed sponsors and new naming rights have come into play. But what's significant about this, though, is that Corinne is, increasingly, I think, at the race of Europe and, on the world tour scene and less on the domestic criterium scene.
Well, she credits, of course, her teammates with getting her, in position to get her to sprint across the line. But it's pretty exciting to see all of these women's races sort of cropping up as companion one-day races to the men's races. And so I think that, people who want to watch cycling have the opportunity to watch exciting women's cycling as well as men's cycling. So that's exciting.
And we're even getting a little bit of televised coverage of the women's racing, which is really, really nice.
Right. Exactly. So you mentioned Team Sky. I don't want to let it slip. Last week we reported about the TUEs and Paul Kimmage's interview with Shane Stokes at, I guess it was a Velo News. No, I think it was a Cycling Tips interview.
Cycling Tips.
So what is going on with Team Sky? I mean, what is your perspective on that?
That's a tough question to answer, obviously, from a distance. But what I can tell you is things don't look good. Even the perception of impropriety is something that I think in a sport that has been plagued by so much scandal, this is something I've read about recently, that, we can't tolerate even the perception of scandal. And so, a lot of different things happening at Team Sky, but a lot of attention being focused around the delivery of some sort of medical aid to Brad Wiggins several years ago through a courier on the team, and there's been very poor record keeping. They insist it was an over-the-counter decongestant that was delivered from Britain. But, clearly with these therapeutic use exemptions, Brad Wiggins was the recipient of some long-lasting corticosteroids, really before the biggest races of his career, on the grounds that it was helping with this decongestant sort of effect that they have, which is certainly sort of like the nuclear bomb of decongestants. So, it looks awfully fishy, and there's been a lot of back and forth with Parliament in Britain. There's major investigations going on there. We'll have to see. It will be interesting to see, Diane, whether Dave Brailsford there at Sky manages to survive in that role, because the appearance of impropriety is certainly very strong. Though I'm not sure we have 100% the smoking gun to suggest that there has been.
Well, that's the way it started with Mr. Armstrong too. The smoking gun was sort of not smoking yet, but once it did, it just exploded. And we certainly do not need another scandal in our sport.
We do not.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dan Worry down in South Carolina, where it hasn't been winter like it has been up here in Cleveland. Anyway, I want to also mention, before we get on with more of the Spring Classic stuff, motors in bikes.
Yeah.
So, e-bikes are a whole different category for people like me who have been in bike shops for 40 years. What is this going on? Do you have any idea?
Well, so, you mentioned e-bikes. I mean, clearly, I think it is pretty well established at this point that there have been, the technological wherewithal to hide small motors. Now, most e-bikes, as have fairly large apparatus around them and a fairly clunky battery. The suggestion, though, here has been, as far as the pro racing goes, that there have been very small motors that have been sort of concealed within these bike frames that have helped to assist riders at critical points during the race. There was a big expose here, and I call it expose in quotes because it turned out really not so much to be, on 60 Minutes here recently, where they were teasing for quite a while. And I'll see if this sort of rings any bells with you, Diane, because what the suggestion here was that they were interviewing the man who theoretically created this technology, and the claim was that back in 1998, that he sold this technology on sort of an exclusive basis to someone who he doesn't know who it was, sort of to an anonymous buyer, on the agreement that it would that he would not make this technology available and not speak about it for 10 years. And so your first clue is 1998. The second clue here is that, they teased in a lot of the media this idea that this was a motor that would work particularly well at a high cadence. And so, all of the bells and whistles should be going off if you followed the sport carefully during that period to know, obviously 1999 was when Lance Armstrong sort of came into prominence and, began, mostly a decade of dominating the Tour de France. Armstrong was, unique in that he used a particularly high pedal cadence. And so, the implication in all of this seemed to be very much building up to this question of, are they trying to imply that they sold this to what then was the U.S. Postal Team for his use? I think everybody tuned in with kind of bated breath to see, what they actually had in this 60 Minutes piece. And ultimately what they had in this 60 Minutes piece was almost nothing. I mean, they interviewed this guy. He sort of, suggested, what I've told you, but, no further implications. I think, who knows, what role attorneys might have played and, kind of preempting some of that. But, that was certainly the implication leading up to that 60 Minutes special that absolutely did not pan out. In fact, I think we ended up learning next to nothing from that 60 Minutes report that wasn't already known. And so their big bombshell expose turned out to kind of fizzle out.
Yeah, it was anticlimactic at best.
Definitely.
Yeah, I did watch it. And wasn't it a Sunday morning or was it a 60 Minutes? I don't remember.
No, and they may have, they may have shown parts of it another, but in 60 Minutes it also put together. But.
Well, and the guy was very cagey. He was just really cagey.
And so, look, I mean, I think, we know the technology exists. We know that at least one rider, a young woman who was competing in a cyclocross race in Europe, has actually been found to have one of these devices in her bike. So we know it's possible. We know the implication is there that, some believe that it has been used in races like the Tour de France, but we certainly don't have the smoking gun at this point to say for certain that it happened in any Tour de France, much less to link it to a particular ride.
Right. Well, mechanical doping. How nice. So let's get back to our spring classics. Paris-Roubaix is coming up on April 9th. So that's a couple of weeks from now. It is still one of the coolest. And you said we could talk about cobbles. So we'll do that.
Let's talk about that for a minute, because okay. it sets the stage really for these classics. Have you ever had the opportunity to go to France and Belgium and ride on these cobbles?
No.
I mean, I would recommend you and to anyone else who is a fan, particularly of these spring classics. This is the dream vacation for any big cycling fan. That and then obviously the Tour de France. But you really get a whole new appreciation of the difficulty of these races when you ride on these historic cobbles. Which I read about this in Bellamy's just this past month. These are to call this a cobbled street is a generous way of describing. I mean, these are all the jagged rocks that are sort of spread out around in a way that, it's amazing that everyone doesn't crash on these cobbles. They really are so perilous and so, jagged and spread in a way that, it's just like begging for a bike tire to get put in there. So they're really amazing to ride over. And then just the difficulty of, getting over each of those cobbles, particularly on the climbs, adds a whole new element. And, I can barely describe to you the sensation of hitting those cobbles, particularly at speed. I think, my first experience riding over them, we were going at a pretty good clip and then sort of turned a corner and there we were on the cobbles. And truly, I thought my eyeballs were going to come out of my head. It is an assault on the senses in every way. Your bike shakes, there's noise, you are shaking so violently that your vision is blurred. So it's an amazing amazing thing to go and do, and just again really gives you an appreciation for these guys that race these cobbled classics. So in terms of looking forward to Flanders and Paris-Roubaix, I think what's been neat about this season and maybe the past couple of years is that we're seeing kind of a changing of the guard when it comes to the spring classics. For many, many years here recently, Roubaix and Flanders have been sort of a competition between Tom Bonin and Fabian Cancellara, who just had this, this legendary rivalry, and it was just a back and forth between these two amazing classics riders. Cancellara has retired at this point, and so we will not be seeing him. And Tom Bonin is actually scheduled to retire after Paris-Roubaix this year. So he is sticking it out for one more round at the classics, but then Paris-Roubaix will mark the end of Tom Bonin's really storied career. So, one story absolutely to watch in Paris-Roubaix is whether Bonin, he is still absolutely formidable in these one-day races, and nobody knows the cobbles and these courses like Tom Bonin. And so, he is definitely someone to watch, though definitely late in his career. The neat thing, though, has been watching now just some of these new rivalries. You mentioned, I think, Peter Sagan, who is just kind of an all-around sensation, but is a very real threat for these one-day classics. Greg Van Avermaet of BMC has really come into his own here in recent years. And then Michael Kwiatkowski of Team Sky, who won Milan-San Remo last year. Last weekend. Won the Strada Bianchi in Italy here a few weeks ago. So it has been, I was kind of lamenting at a point that, what are the classics going to be like now when we don't have Bonin and Cancellara anymore, and here we've got this new crop of guys that are really coming into their own. So, if I had to tip a couple of riders to watch, definitely those would be the ones for Paris-Roubaix.
Well, the one thing we didn't mention when we were talking about cobbles is what happens when not only you hit them, but you hit them and they're wet.
Yes, it can be incredibly, there's even more than just wetness. The the rain and the mud that become involved in these races. These are old dirt paths, really. And so, when these rocks become wet and muddy, they're incredibly slippery. The other thing that they deal with, particularly in some of the segments in Paris-Roubaix, in the Arenberg Forest, for example, is that there is like a moss that grows at times of the year. So, usually around this time of year, several weeks before Paris-Roubaix, there are volunteers who are out there actually kind of scrubbing, and they use street cleaners and things to go over and try to get some of that moss off of the rock so that it's not quite as, I believe you may, riding on these cobblestones clean is plenty perilous already for riders. You don't need them to be wet or mossy to make them even more dangerous.
Well, I think we actually had a conversation with somebody about the tire choices that you need to make based on what the day is going to be like on these cobbled classics. I do not want to leave our conversation without talking about the Giro this year. It will be 100 years old. It will be 21 stages, almost 3,600 kilometers, several mountaintop finishes. It's just such a classic race. I know everybody talks about the Tour de France, but the Giro d'Italia is an excellent, excellent stage race.
Absolutely. And it promises to be a great one this year. I think if I had to point to someone there, Nairo Quintana, Team Movistar, is certainly someone to watch. He will be there and really has his target set on this race. Even looking here for the past couple of years at the Tour de France, it has been sort of this back and forth between Froome and Quintana. I think Quintana has struggled to overcome some of the unique skills that Chris Froome has and is able to put together for the Tour de France. But I think in his absence that, looking at Quintana at the Giro is going to be someone absolutely to watch. Also, the defending champion of Vincenzo Nibali will be there, who's riding for Bahrain Merida this year. Fabio Arulu from Astana will be there. Tom Delamont, Dave Moulin of Sunweb. So some great riders planning to be there at the Giro.
Yeah, and I'm hoping we get a lot of television coverage. It's really, really good and an interesting race. I like Italy a lot. So I guess we still have to say something about the Tour de France. It is, of course, everybody's sort of go-to favorite. If you ask somebody about bicycle racing who knows nothing about bicycle racing, they do know the Tour de France.
Sure. And I think, again, this year, now, with the caveat that it's very early in the season, and
right,
it's really hard to predict, what will happen between now and then, and injuries certainly come into play in cycling. And so, it's really impossible even at this point to say who will be at the Tour de France. But, with all of those caveats, I mean, it's hard not to say that Chris Froome isn't, again, the favorite for Team Sky. He rode such an amazing race last year and really surprised, I think, people in a lot of different ways. Did some, had amazing downhill attack last year. You remember him running up a mountain without his bike after a crash last year.
I forgot about that.
With Chris Froome. But, he is, I was mentioning the kind of back and forth between he and Quintana. For all of these races, whether it's the Classics or the Grand Tour, they cater to very different kinds of riders, right? So the Classics tend to cater maybe not to the smallest riders who, are super specialists high up in the mountains, guys like Sagan and Greg Van Avermaet and Tom Bonin. Whereas, the Grand Tours require a really unique set of skills as well, because we're talking about racing over 21 days in a variety of different settings and geographies. And so, to be a really successful Grand Tour rider, you need certainly to be, a strong enough rider that on those sprint stages, you can stay right up front. Maybe you're not, contesting the sprint itself to stay out of danger, but you can stay, right up at the front when things get going real fast on those sprint stages. You need to be an amazing climber, maybe not, a strict, climbing specialist who is only good at that, but you need to be, a great climber, a great kind of one-day racer, and then also a really amazing time trialist, because that's, that has really been, in a number of years, the deciding factor between these riders is their ability to race against the clock. And so, Chris Froome from Team Sky has this unique set of skills that just really suit him well for the Tour de France. Quintana of Team Movistar, you know, has almost that same set of skills, but is at this point just not as strong a time trialist as Froome, and that has made a real difference in his ability to try to overcome Team Sky at the Tour de France. So, you know, barring injury or anything else, I would have to tip Chris Froome to come back for another Tour de France run at this point.
Lastly, I want to talk a little bit about the North American races. So we've got some big ones. Obviously, we have California, we have Colorado, we have the Tour of Alberta. Do you think that the European race scene will ever look similar in the U.S.? Is it growing? It's so hard to tell what's going on. I think cyclocross, of course, is the big thing in the U.S., and it's typical of the kind of, it's like cowboys, you know?
You know, it's hard to tell whether it's growing in the United States in some regard, and that is because these races, you know, have struggled financially to put together the sponsorship. It's incredibly costly to put on, you know, a world-class road cycling event, you know, anywhere, but, you know, certainly much, you know, here in the United States. We were talking about closing off huge stretches of road. I mean, these riders routinely cover, you know, 100-plus miles a day. You know, that's just a major logistical challenge. And in terms of providing things like television coverage, you know, it's very costly to put on these events. And so, you know, you may remember that for several years we had the USA Pro Cycling Challenge in Colorado, which was an amazing race that, you know, eventually the organizers just couldn't put together the funding for. You know, the races like, you know, the Tour of Georgia have, you know, come and gone. And so, you know, here in the States, I think, you know, the big question is, you know, the economic viability of these races. The Engine Tour of California has now really pretty well established itself, but you know, I know that's a costly thing. We're looking at a new race, you know, coming to Colorado as well. So, you know, great stuff, and it's neat to see some World Tour racing right here in the United States. But you know, whether we can get, you know, as I mentioned, you know, going back to the classics, when we're looking at races like Milan-San Remo that have been going on since, you know, the late 1800s or early 1900s, we've got a long way to go before our races get to that sort of status. But it's still great fun to have them around.
Yeah, it is. I agree. And we have seen in the many years I've been in the business, we have seen a lot of races come and go. And you hate to see them go, but you understand, you know, there has to be some sort of a return on investment to the sponsors. And sometimes it's tough. Last question is about the political climate worldwide. Do you think there will be any interference with the cycling season, given what's going on politically around the world?
Oh, gosh, I need to knock on wood here somewhere, Diane, because that's such a hard question, and something that I think, you know, we've, you know, in the media we've talked a little bit about it. You know, cycling is a unique sport in so many different regards. I mean, just getting back to that idea of even staging these races, that they might happen over 100-plus miles of open road. And, you know, you think about those, you know, those iconic climbs on the Tour de France where the, you know, the fans are just literally right there on top of the athletes and, you know, I mean, they're literally touching them, pushing them in some cases. You know, when we have, you know, situations where there becomes conflict between the riders and the fans on the road. So really in no other sport do we have the kind of direct access to the athlete as we do in some cases in cycling. And that, you know, that's a scary proposition in a world that is, you know, sometimes seeming to be a dangerous and kind of upside down place. You know, we have these you know, these awful, you know, attacks around the world, and so, you know, I think there is definitely a concern, and the UCI is certainly looking at, you know, whatever it can do to help to secure these you know, these iconic events in Europe. But it's a real important question that you're asking. I'm not sure we know the answer, other than that we hope and pray that you know, that never would anything like that happen.
Yeah, we would hope so. Let's wish Mario Cipollini a happy 50th birthday as we close out our...
the yeah. Lion King.
Is that amazing or what? It's sort of like, I feel like now I really feel old.
I'm sure he wore something very demure and understated.
Yeah, that would be him, right. Yeah, somebody came out this week with, I think, the 25 coolest looking cyclists, and there were some good, I think Marcel Kittel was the one who was, everybody's going, well, there's a good looking guy, and he is, he's really good looking guy. Anyway, it is so good to talk with you and catch up. We will do this again as the Grand Tours start coming up and we'll see who's contending. And I hope you continue to have a wonderful year down there in South Carolina.
Thanks so much, Dan. I always enjoy being with you.
All right. Thank you. Have a good afternoon and take care. Bye-bye. Dan Worry joined me from his home in South Carolina. I always appreciate what he has to say. I love talking with him. I always learn something new. And I want to thank him for being on the show this week. I'd also like to thank Keith Laughlin from Rails to Trails and Carol Montgomery, whose warm showers location down in Texas sounds like a little dream come true on 10 acres and your own private bunkhouse. So I want to remind you that we will post the two web addresses to the appropriations committees, both the House and the Senate, on our Facebook page. If you'd like to get some information about that and find out if somebody on one of those committees is from your state, you can contact them if you wish. We will be back next week with a brand new show. If you have a chance, remember, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.